Today on Maine Calling, the collective trauma of mass shootings, both real and hoaxes. 2 weeks ago, several Maine schools faced what turned out to be a horrifying hoax. Someone had called in reports of an active shooter on campus. Schools scrambled to make sure their students were safe, locking down facilities and calling police. Many students ended up hiding for hours. How does an incident like this affect everyone involved? Psychologists say even if the threat turns out to be a hoax, the trauma from the event can be very real. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we will look at the cultural impact of this new reality in which mass shootings are on the rise and schools and workplaces hold active shooter training sessions. How does this stress change us? And how to cope? Maine Calling is just ahead.
Maine Calling On Demand is made possible by Welsh & Forbes, working with clients to manage the full range of events that come with building wealth, from investments to trustee services. More at welshforbes.com. And by Maine Seacoast Mission, strengthening Maine's coastal and island communities through education, health, and support. Learn more at seacoastmission.org.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Tune into the news these days, and chances are you hear about a shooting somewhere. Here in Maine, the threat of school shootings 2 weeks ago turned out to be a hoax, but it disrupted schools and terrified communities. Today, we're going to talk about how these threats affect us directly and indirectly, and what we can do about it. On the line with me, Karen Barnes, who is a Behavioral Threat Assessment and Mental Health Coordinator with the Maine School Safety Center at the Maine Department of Education. Michael Berman, Professor of Psychology and Academic Director with the School of Social and Behavioral Science at the University of New England. And Bear Shea, Licensed Clinical Social Worker and School Counseling Specialist with the Maine Department of Education. We invite you to join the conversation. Were you living in one of the communities affected by the threats 2 weeks ago? Are you finding yourself turning off the news because you can't take it anymore? Do you have personal experience with an incident? You can share your comments and questions by email, talk@mainepublic.org, post a comment on social media, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. 3566. Thank you all for talking with us today. Bear Shea, I'll start with you. It's not a good idea to say that what happened in Maine 2 weeks ago was only a hoax, right? It was still a really big deal and very traumatic for the people involved.
Yeah, I believe when we talk about it as a hoax, it can sometimes feel like while we are glad that the worst didn't happen, we also know that this type of event is designed to cause disruption, is designed to, sort of prey on us. And so when we're saying it's a hoax, I think it sometimes can feel like we are, minimizing the impact that it has, when really this type of a threat is designed to have an impact. In some ways, this was a successful event. The people behind this threat were using it as a way to disrupt our schools, disrupt our communities, and to sort of have a negative impact on our communities at large.
And this specific kind of threat is called swatting, correct? Explain that to me.
Yeah, so the term swatting comes out of sort of the computer world, and it was a way to sort of falsely identify someone's residence and call in a threat. So, calling in the police and saying that there's a person with a weapon or that there's some type of mortal threat at that home, causing the SWAT team to show up with, sirens on and guns drawn. That has really expanded into being used as a tool for threat and terror. And we know that this swatting event took place across, the entire country. It wasn't just here in Maine, and that it was calculated to have this negative impact and disruption. And so it's now being used as a tool to have these negative impacts.
Karen, an incident of threat and terror, from where you sit, give us a sense of what happens and what the impacts are in a school community.
Thank you for that question. And I just want to reiterate what Bear said, in that, you know, these type of events elicit the same fear and anxiety. And, you know, the body's response is exactly the same, whether the threat is credible and carried out. You know, as Bear mentioned, thankfully, it wasn't this time. But I think, you know, we have to be really careful not to diminish that, you know, the effect that it has on school personnel, parents, the entire community, and first responders. I think we forget sometimes, you know, about the first responders, but I think, entire communities were affected by this event.
How is this, Karen, different than, I'm using air quotes here, you know, the olden days when kids would want to get out of exams and call in a bomb threat, and schools usually kind of knew when it wasn't real. This is a whole different situation, isn't it? And schools have to take everything seriously.
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, one of the contributing factors to that is the exposure on, you know, on the news media when there is a school shooting. The reality is that schools are very safe places for kids and for the adults that work there. I think what happens, though, is because it's so sensationalized and the results are catastrophic when a school shooting is carried out. So I think that, yes, schools have to respond. And that's why planning is so critical. And I think Melissa's going to come talk about that a little bit, too, that, you know, you don't want to be planning in the middle of an event for your response. You know, we are really working with schools and encouraging them to have these prevention plans in place, but also response. So, you know, the whole gamut, schools need to have that, the spectrum of a response.
Mike, we've been talking about these threats. We've been talking about the fact that the real school shootings are on the news. Also, kids are, and adults at their workplaces, do things like active shooter drills. They train for when this happens. How does sort of the totality of that affect students, affect young people? The idea that, one, there are real school shootings on the news. Two, there may be threats in their own school. And three, well, we're going to train for this just in case.
Yeah, thanks, Jennifer. That's a great question. So, you know, I think Karen talked about the threats and the trauma being bad for the people in the schools. And really, in my mind, that's about the perceived safety, maybe even more so than the real safety. And when we perceive a threat, it activates our body's stress systems. We have our sympathetic nervous system, which puts us in that fight or flight mode, gets us ready to run or flee or save our lives. That's supposed to be a very short-term system. It mobilizes our energy, shuts down our immune system, shuts down our digestion. It makes us hypervigilant and anxious, looking for threat in order to allow us to get away from that danger. And if that lasts and the danger persists, we then have other systems that release cortisol and other hormones that really mobilize our body to fight threat and cause us to feel this anxiety to attend to those threats and flee from them or fight against them. And what happens in these chronic situations where it lasts all day or many days or it's been triggered over and over again by social media and hearing about threats, as we start to live in this constant state of anxiety, our stress and sympathetic nervous system remain active, and then our body can't heal. Then our cholesterol stays in our bloodstream, then our blood pressure stays elevated, and we stay hypervigilant. We don't relax, we don't calm down, we don't heal, we don't recover, we don't process these things correctly. And that's where we really start to see some of these mental and physical health impacts arise.
We know that our young people are already experiencing a mental health crisis, that the rates of anxiety and depression are just skyrocketing. How does something like what happened 2 weeks ago in Maine affect the people in those school communities?
Yeah, thanks, Jennifer. You know, I have two kids. They're 15 and 12 right now. And I think about the isolation from the pandemic. I think about the social pressures they're facing. I think about these real health information they're facing. And then I think about things like this, which just pile on top of this baseline of anxiety and this baseline of isolation. And many of our coping mechanisms, the things that kids do to feel healthy and be healthy, just haven't existed. And so I think kids are suffering. I think a lot about that.
Bear, how? Go ahead. Yeah.
I was going to say, I think there, you know, these types of threats have a larger impact. Certainly, you know, our students that are already, you know, we know are struggling through the pandemic, and really that's all of us. You know, so we're talking about an impact on the educators that are there, that, you know, are there trying to make sure that students are safe and accessing their education, parents that, you know, had students texting them that day, and community members who, you know, care about children's safety. And so this really has that large ripple impact, you know, on communities that have already borne so much from the pandemic, and that we're all sort of in that survival space. We're still dealing with that long-term impact from the pandemic, and a lot of those kind of traditional support systems that are there were also negatively impacted. So, you know, being able to turn to our peers, being able to turn towards family members, you know, a lot of those things were eroded in the past 2 years. And so being really intentional on how we're bringing, building back those supports, and really, really doing it on purpose. You know, this is more than just taking some downtime. This is really, how are we reaching out and building relationships with each other and bolstering those resilience factors, and really looking at not only the impact from the events, but then also how are we putting in plans in place so that we're mitigating that fear in an ongoing way, and unfortunately, if this should happen again.
I want to ask all of you a variety of the same question, advice for coping, not only for students and families involved in school incidents, but also all of us who are facing, who are engaged, who watch and listen to the news, who are aware of what's happening around the country, how to best cope. And it sounds to me, Karen, like part of it for you is to, and I do this as well, is to look at the statistics and to face the reality that even though this is on the news, the statistics mean that it is still exceedingly rare.
It is. And in fact, and I think that, you know, when we talk about the planning, you know, stages for, you know, how, and Bear, you hit it right on the head when you said to, you know, we can mitigate the fear when we plan well, and, you know, community members, students, staff, they're really looking to the leaders in these schools when something happens like this to take charge of that. So I think, you know, to answer your question, Jennifer, I think communication is probably at the top of the list. You know, so I would say to anyone out there who's experiencing any fear, you know, knowledge is power. And I think that if we can, if the more we know, you know, the better we do. So ask those questions. If you're a parent and you have, you know, questions around how your child's school will handle an emergency, it's fine to ask them, do you have a plan? You know, do you have a plan for an active shooter? Do you have a plan? Do you have a behavioral threat assessment team? You know, so we can identify students who may be at risk. So I think, you know, knowledge is, I think, the key.
And Mike, I'll turn to you. We see not only school shootings, but shootings in places like Walmarts, concerts, nightclubs. I know that there are people, I know people who avoid public places now because of fear. What would you say to all of us about coping with the reality that every year there are more mass shootings in America than the year before?
Yeah, thanks, Jennifer. That's a great question. You know, trauma happens. And one of the keys is resolution from it and returning to that feeling of safety, allowing your body and your mind to heal from that. You know, one of my roles is as a city councilor in Saco, and during the recent, you know, SWAT events, what we saw is we saw a bunch of misinformation going out on social media, and we saw our kids constantly hitting refresh, you know, all day and all night and the next day, and they really lived in this chronic heightened threat environment, and in part doing it to each other, really re-emphasizing and focusing on the danger as opposed to the reality, as Karen has told us, that schools are overwhelmingly safe, right? In Maine, we're overwhelmingly safe. And I think that becomes the thing to focus on, is not to live in this danger, not to re-emphasize it, not allow it to replay in our house and in our minds and in our conversations over and over again, because that really heightens the risk. That keeps us in that hypervigilant state where we start to get anxiety and depression and those overwhelmed feelings as if we have no control over our safety. But instead, to emphasize that we are safe and schools are safe. These events are rare. There are plans in place. We've done the drills. The staff know what they're doing. our police are effective, and we're safe. And as you start to talk about that and emphasize that and discuss that with your neighbors and your family, and especially our children, projecting that sense of safety and calm to our children, I think that can really go a long way towards bringing us out of that trauma state and into a state of healing.
And Bear, you?
It's a complicated conversation, I think, particularly because we are steeped in a culture right now that really is focusing on gun violence and the sort of tragic fallout that happens to communities when that violence is present. And I think because we're steeped in that, our brains are focused and heightened on that impact. And so while we can look at statistics and we can look at data information that says very clearly that we are very safe, that replay and that mirror of that trauma, you know, it's something that our brains are very heightened to and focused on. And it's really hard to take in the rational data when our minds are operating in this survival space that can sometimes feel a little irrational. And so that disconnect is really difficult. You know, when we think about statistics, you know, driving in a car to school is still more risky than being at school. And yet we don't think of it the same way. And I think, you know, that's when we look at where risk is in our lives, we downplay that risk in other areas. And when risk is heightened like this at such a cultural level, and we see such a large impact, it's really difficult to put that into that sort of logical place. And so it makes it really difficult.
Today,
One of the things I've been thinking about is the distinction between being safe and feeling safe. And you know, our schools are overwhelmingly safe. And one of the things we do to make them safe is we do these drills and these lockdown practices, and we have these discussions and trainings. And while those undoubtedly make us safer and have the staff and students know what to do in those events, they can also reinforce that feeling of non-safety, because it becomes ever present and it becomes part of our daily life. And we think about then these threats even more often. And that's one where I really kind of get stuck on what's good for our actual safety, maybe reinforcing some of these anxieties and fears and traumas.
Yeah, we are talking about threats of mass shootings and how they affect us. If you have a comment, you can give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. Send an email to talk@mainepublic.org or find us on social media. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Today on the program, we are talking about the threats of school shootings, the threats of shootings in public places, and what that news does to our collective public health and what we can do to help ourselves. Joining me, Mike Berman, psychology professor and academic director with the University of New England, Bear Shea, social worker and school counseling specialist with the Maine Department of Education. He coordinates the Climate, Culture, and Resilience team at the State Office of School and Student Supports. And Karen Barnes, behavioral threat assessment and mental health coordinator with the DOE's School Safety Center. You can join our conversation by email, talk@mainepublic.org, comment on social media, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. On the line with us now is Melissa Condon. She's coordinator of the Maine Department of Education's School Emergency Management, part of the School Safety Center. Thanks so much for joining us, Melissa.
Yes, and good morning. Thank you for having me.
We're talking about how shootings in schools and other places affect people. It would be helpful to hear what school security measures kick in when there is a threat of shootings. What was happening in Maine schools when the recent swatting hoax threats came in?
You know, that's a really dynamic question. A response to any incident is very comprehensive. There's multiple levels depending on what the incident is and the scale in which that incident is going to take place. The number of people involved, again, and the type of threat or hazard that exists. Our schools are working diligently across the state to develop plans that are comprehensive in nature on the front end, so during a response, they can align with and be prepared to coordinate a response with other agencies and partners coming to scene. What we experienced a couple weeks ago when the swatting events happened is that, you know, emergency plans really are a comprehensive look, and they're like a guidebook the more effort that they put into these plans beforehand, as we've talked, you know, there's a change in your body and your dynamic when an incident happens and the way you react. And these plans kind of help work through those emotions and feelings that may distract your clear thinking processes during a response. And so we've seen, and we encourage everybody to continue to look at their plans and revise and build upon lessons learned from where we were fortunate not to experience any casualties, but we still went through an actual event.
How do Maine schools stay on top of security matters? How do you know what matters are real and what are not?
Absolutely. So there's national standards for threat and hazard identification and risk analysis. And the from the federal level down to the lowest local level in the smallest town, we can utilize something referred to as the THIRA, and that is the threat and hazard and risk identification or identification risk assessment. And this tool allows you to take a realistic look at what is around you. If we look at a school, what happens inside your building? What happens just outside? Do you run on well water? Do you have propane that heats your school? Are you near a dam or a train track? And you can take a realistic look at what you may be impacted by and kind of prioritize those and apply mitigation strategies to try and reduce or eliminate the impact if something were to go wrong. And so we work with schools to help with that. We work very closely with the county emergency management agencies, the state agency, to help schools identify those threats and hazards in a very realistic and pragmatic way.
And Melissa, finally, I'm sure you heard what Michael said before the break. What do you think about that tricky balance between being prepared for disasters while trying to maintain a sense of normalcy and not scaring kids?
Absolutely. So when we're working with students, and really we can apply this to any business across the spectrum of our community, if we use a trauma-informed approach to teach the actions that need to happen during an incident, regardless of what the threat or hazard is, we can take away that conversation of what it is that we're training for and teach the actions to keep our bodies safe. An evacuation, for example, is very closely associated with fire. But in fact, an evacuation is intended to get people outside the building or inside the building away from a threat inside the building, right? To get outside and away from it. A lockdown is to help people inside the building stay safe from something happening inside the building. So if we actually look at the actions, we can teach the things that we do to keep our bodies safe, much like wearing a seatbelt. We don't need to tell our youth and explain what happens if you don't wear a seatbelt. We explain that by wearing a seatbelt, we keep ourselves safe. And so if we approach it with that dynamic, we can use a trauma-informed approach and help empower them with the knowledge they need to keep themselves and others safe.
Melissa, thanks so much for calling in. Melissa Condon coordinates emergency management with the Maine DOE. I'm going to go to some questions here from the audience. A tweet here. As a member of the LGBTQ+ community, I am deeply concerned for my safety. I'm going to a convention tomorrow, and I'm honestly worried something bad might happen. It wears on you and your mental health. Mike.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's right. That chronic background threats and anxiety of not knowing when and where danger might approach is exactly what wears on our mental health and causes long-term depression and anxiety. That's really why we're all seeking that feeling of safety, and we want that predictability. We want to be able to differentiate when we're safe from when we're not. And that's really the danger of these chronic background threats.
I'm going to go to David. Also, yeah, go ahead, Bear.
Oh, I'm sorry. I just think it's also really important to acknowledge that some of us are more at risk than others. And it's really important to, give validity to that, and that some of us are members of groups or minorities or have, a historical experience with violence. And so some of us are more affected and more at risk than others. And that long-term effect can also have an impact. You know, when we're talking about that physiological effect of trauma over time, those of us that have experienced violence or have historical violence in our communities, that can have a lasting impact. And so I think it's really important to offer extra support for those communities. And we know that violence is disproportionate. So it's important to recognize.
Let's see. We'll go to Mackenzie calling from Portland. Hi, Mackenzie. Go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I definitely appreciate the conversation around, you know, not kind of going into a fear-mongering state culturally, but I'm also calling because I'm hoping that we can kind of introduce into the conversation some of the actions that we can take preventatively. I actually have a three-year-old and was in an ultrasound for my child that's due in a couple of weeks when I got a notification that his daycare was under lockdown. And it's just, it was, you know, it is traumatizing, but it's also like, we don't have to live like this. And there are organizations that are working on, you know, preventative programs that are like Sandy has promised with Know the Signs that can come to your school, or, you know, every town that's doing a lot of advocacy around, you know, common sense gun control. And is that going, I'd love to just kind of hear somebody speak to that part of the conversation, as opposed to simply what do we do when this stuff happens?
Yeah, Karen Barnes.
Sure. Thanks, Mackenzie. That's a really great question, and I appreciate the opportunity to address that with you. So in Maine schools right now, I can speak just from the school perspective, but we are training behavioral threat assessment teams to identify a possible threat to safety, to manage that and provide an intervention plan and monitor. So schools, and in fact, we had a big training yesterday. We had four more SAUs trained yesterday. We use a program called CSTAG. It's Comprehensive School Threat Assessment Guidelines. And what that does is it gives schools a way to systematically address threats the same way every time. So I think, you know, Mackenzie, you're right. You hit it right on the head when we talk about prevention. You know, that's where our power is, really. So I think it's training the adults who work with the children and law enforcement as well are on these teams. So, you know, everybody's kind of on the same side, intervening at the earliest point possible for behavioral threat assessment and management. Thank you.
Mike, I'm wondering if you can give us some guidance about how parents might talk to their kids when they're personally feeling the stress of what's on the news.
Yeah, you know, it was interesting. I had a conversation with the SACO, the superintendent of schools, about this yesterday and about how we have to really talk in an age-appropriate way. It may be that in our youngest kids, they don't really need to know exactly what's happening. They need adults to tell them that they're safe, that they're secure, that they're engaging in the appropriate behaviors, and to come home to that same sense of security and a chance to talk about, you know, what their concerns were and to debrief and to engage in conversation with trusted adults who are projecting a sense of safety and security. And as we get older, of course, it becomes harder and harder to control that information. You know, my teenagers are on TikTok and social media, and they're sharing information and really misinformation with each other. And I think that's where it becomes important also is to correct that misinformation. There was a great deal of misinformation going around our communities, you know, 2 weeks ago about what was happening and where it was happening and who was harmed. And that really caused a cycle of anxiety in my teens and their peers. And I think it becomes on the onus of the adults in their lives to explain both the truth and the facts, but also what the schools are doing and what we as communities are doing to keep our kids safe and that we're effective and that we have a plan and that the state and the schools and the police are working together in order to ensure that they're safe. And that will depend upon the age of your kids and what they're ready to handle. And as Bear pointed out earlier, both our individual and collective histories with these traumas will, you know, inform how we talk to our kids also.
Bear.
Yeah, I think that age appropriate piece is so important. And really to go back to what the caller was saying earlier, while we don't need to go into sort of a fear mongering where we're really focusing on what happened, really validating that something did happen. And you know, I think we have this sort of, you know, classic main belief of like, all right, we got through this, we're going to kind of soldier on, move forward and like get past this and focus on the next thing. And there's a real importance to allowing some space to process, and not just intellectually, not just talking about it, but specifically for our younger kids, their bodies were impacted, right? All of our bodies are impacted by an event like this. And so giving kids the space, giving them the attention, and sort of understanding that they're going to be possibly behaving in ways that we're not sort of used to. And so making sure that we're giving some extra attention, knowing that something happened that impacted them. So for our older kids, it's involving them in the process. You know, it's our teenagers trying to activate and to sort of you know, how are we going after this? How are we planning? What are the steps that we're taking? And that can help us feel sort of engaged and safer that we're doing something. For our younger kids, it's going to be, you know, processing and playing and working with their bodies and really giving them that extra cuddle time and affection and really focusing on those relationships. And we can take those pieces out into our communities. So it's giving other people extra time and space, knowing that they might have been that they were probably impacted by this, and that different people are going to be impacted in different ways. And so giving that little bit of extra sort of attention and a little bit of extra kindness, a little bit of extra structure in the day to sort of help us all as we're going through this as a community.
Calling in now is Camilla Shannon, who is board chair for the Maine Gun Safety Coalition, which advocates for policy changes, including red flag laws and universal background checks. Thanks so much for calling in, Cam. And you've heard some of the recommendations from our panelists about ways to cope in the face of increased mass shootings. I'm guessing that you believe getting involved in advocacy is a good way to respond.
Well, actually, that was exactly the point I was going to start with. I was going to say that in my experience, one of the root causes of anxiety is a loss of agency. And we don't just have to plan for emergency situations. We have the power to work to prevent them. So my organization, as you've already alluded, advocates for common sense gun safety policies that can prevent such tragedies from happening.
Is it tricky to focus on gun regulations in a state like Maine, where guns are considered part of the culture and have been for many years?
Well, we try to take a public health response, recognizing that we have a long tradition of sportsmanship in our state. But the hunters I know best are some of the first advocates and strongest advocates for safety. And that's really the approach we're taking. Common sense measures to reduce the risk of gun violence and save Maine lives.
Well, thank you, Cam Shannon with the Maine Gun Safety Coalition. We're going to go back to David from Penobscot. David, are you there now?
I am here. I hope you're hearing me.
Yeah, go ahead.
Great, thank you. Just to go back to the issue of our LGBTQ youth who are under attack, not only by witnessing and hearing about the horrific gun violence that's meted out against the LGBT community, two major national incidents over the last few years, and including, of course, the recent one in Colorado Springs. But we have to connect the dots. The LGBTQ youth are under attack within their own schools by horrific conspiracy theories that are driving parents to come to school board meetings and absolutely demean LGBTQ youth, disparaging remarks. Dig deep when you're young and you're learning who you are, and you're surrounded by peers that are encouraged to, you know, marginalize you and suppress you even more. The threat of taking books off the shelf, the threat of teachers not being able to have honest communication with those young students who are feeling these attacks. When they see five people shot in a nightclub in Colorado Springs, they see that as their future when it's going that route. We see the state of Florida, the state of Texas, and numerous other states passing laws to prevent their having safe, healthy growing up years while they're still in school, because they are being marginalized and suppressed by parents who are fearing something that's not out there. We need
David,
to open up our schools to honesty. So
thank you for that. Thank you for that perspective. And I'm going to turn to Bear. Go ahead, Bear.
Well, and I think it really does go back to that fact that violence is disproportionate, and that it does affect, you know, different groups differently. And that, you know, whether people are targeted with violence due to their race, due to their religion, due to their gender or sexuality, we know that these groups have been targeted historically, and many other groups have been targeted with different kinds of violence historically, and that when we see that reflected in the news and we see that happening in the day to day, that those specific groups are targeted, it's going to impact members of that group in a more intense way. And so making sure that we're providing extra supports, extra, you know, relationship building with those groups, really going out of our way for each other to really show that we are supportive, and that our communities are against violence of any kind. And that schools certainly, you know, that part of planning, that part of preparation, it's not just about hardening the building. It's not about, you know, closing doors and putting in metal detectors. It's really about building communities that, you know, have support networks that are there to protect their schools and to keep kids safe. And that's all kids. Every single one of our students in Maine deserves the right to access a school in a nonviolent space. And that's really what we endeavor to do with the Department of Education and providing those supports, providing, you know, specialists to be able to plan for those things and to be able to be in schools that provide that access to a nonviolent school for every student.
We're going to take another quick break. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you are listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, how the constant threat of shootings affects us. With me, Bear Shea, social worker and mental health specialist with the Department of Education. Karen Barnes, also with the Maine DOE. She's with the School Safety Center. And Mike Berman, behavioral neuroscientist with the University of New England. You can join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email, if you're quick, to talk@mainepublic.org or find us on social media. I'm going to go to Sarah, who's calling from Portland. Hi, Sarah. Go ahead.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. I'm a pediatric occupational therapist, and I've worked in the schools for about 10 years. And I just wanted to say that to me, the threat is not at all guns. It's disconnection in childhood. It's disconnection that children are facing to them, of themselves, to each other, and the trusted adults in their environment in the school setting. You know, when screens are used for transitions to learn, when children are given worksheets and discouraged from communicating with each other, they have limited outdoor time to play and be outside. I feel as if their child development is being stunted. And this creates anxiety and confusion in children. And these are the kids that kind of end up in these unfortunate situations as potentially being the shooter or being the bully. Children, when they play, they participate in their occupation of play. They're connecting. They're problem solving. They're using executive functioning skills. They're dealing with their emotions. This is unstructured play. And they do not have this opportunity in school anymore. And I really believe that, you know, when we talk about the behavioral threat assessment team, I'm wondering if they are examining the occupation of play and how beneficial that is to children and how that could be an enormous preventative measure in these tragedies.
Sarah, thank you. I'll turn to you, Mike Berman.
Yeah, thanks. I can't speak to what the schools are doing. Maybe one of our DOE colleagues can. But I can say that social connection is one of the strongest predictors of mental health and recovery from things like anxiety and depression. Our social supports are the predictor of long-term outcomes, followed closely by movement and exercise. These are two of the things that are just so predictive of our long-term health, our long-term well-being, our sense of well-being, and our sense of self. And for kids, a lot of that is play. And as we watch both the decline of play in schools, but then also the decline of free play at home and an increasingly scheduled, regimented childhood filled with screens rather than spontaneous play and outdoor activity. I'm very sympathetic with the caller. I think she's really onto something.
Sarah, thanks for your call. I want to go here to an email. This is from Chris Greeley, who is with the chief of the Holden Police Department. The chief writes, unfortunately, the threat of another school shooting not only occupies the minds of teachers and students, but obviously law enforcement. I don't know what the answer to this is, but it is constantly something police departments in Maine think about. And Karen, you were mentioning earlier, I think, emergency response workers and their trauma from having to think about this all the time.
Yes, absolutely. And I think, you know, we automatically go to, just by virtue of what we do for work, we go to, you know, the students' mental health, the staff at the school's mental health, the administration, the social workers within the school. But first responders work closely with schools. We are really fortunate in this state to have our first responders so working so closely with individuals at the school level. But as Melissa mentioned earlier, also with our main school safety center team, you know, they're involved in every step of the planning with us. And the impact is profound. And I think that we just need to acknowledge and validate that.
I'm going to go to Patrick calling from Wells. Hi, Patrick. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for taking my phone. I want to say, you know, from the onset that, you know, anyone in education, you know, they're really doing a labor of love. However, I've heard, you know, from two of your panels there saying that the schools are safe. I don't feel the schools are safe, you know, because anyone can go and obtain a gun anywhere and, you know, go to the supermarket, the church, or the school. So until that is addressed, you know, the availability of, weapons of mass destruction, you know, I don't think, you know, it's right to say the schools are safe. I think that has to be addressed, you know, if you say the schools are safe compared to which other countries, you know, we have the highest incidence of school shooting in U.S. than any other country. So I think, you know, they should, you know, I understand they're trying to calm everyone down, you know, not to be anxious every time. However, you know, we have to face reality that, you know, the schools are, you know, at risk at any day. So that's what I wanted to say. I hope they, you know, they address that.
Yeah. I'll go to you first, Bear.
I mean, I think that's it. It is one of the concerns in that when we're talking about schools being safe, it's not an absolute, right? We know that there's a risk to our everyday life, and that really through that emergency management and planning, we're really looking to mitigate that risk as much as possible. But prevention really needs to go outside of what the schools and communities are trying to do. And we know that there are other avenues to reduce the impacts of gun violence and violence in general. And so there is a larger conversation that is happening and needs to continue to happen. And how are we reducing the avenues to violence and particularly mass violence? And so I appreciate that call and just that reminder. And I think it's always difficult where we're trying not to overreact, and we certainly don't want to underreact. We really want to acknowledge that this was a significant event. It was a significant impact, and that it has a larger impact on us because of this broader national culture we have in our country of gun violence. And then that really echoes and increases this impact. So I appreciate that call. And I think that community response of how we're reducing violence as Americans.
Karen.
Yes, I agree with Bear. And I just wanted to clarify that, you know, we can't say without exception that, you know, schools are completely safe and that there will not be an act of violence, targeted violence in our schools. But just to clarify, when we say that, we're comparing to mass attacks in other public spaces as compared to schools, when we say that schools are much safer.
And Mike.
Yeah, one of the things I think about when I listen to that caller is feeling safe kind of starts with being safe. But one of the interesting things in our community and in our nation is we have different ways of thinking about how to be safe when thinking about gun violence. For some people, having police in schools makes them feel safer. Others feel less safe when they see a strong police presence in schools. Some people react to gun violence by wanting to get rid of guns and put in additional gun controls. Others seek to expand gun ownership. And then that's what makes solving some of these problems really hard, is that we're all seeking safety. But we do so in sometimes incompatible ways that exacerbate others' fears, kind of creating these cycles.
Patrick, thank you for your call. We'll move up to Bangor and Lucille. Hi, Lucille. Go ahead.
Hi. They had an expression during World War II, loose leaf lips sink ships. And I think that too much information is given to the media. They had something on the media a few weeks ago on your station about teenage boy who was ingenious. He hid in the music room. He knew that there was a loose ceiling tile. He could hide up there, and he knew he could hide in a drum. Luckily, the shooter did not come to that room. But I think they put too much information on the media. When you work in private industry, for example, 9/11, they had things that happened about oil barges and all kinds of protective things that happened that never made the public. I think this information should only go to the school board, the superintendent, the principal, the students, and the parents, not on public media, because it's giving people too many ideas. Thank you.
All right, Lucille, it sounds like a whole nother conversation about what is appropriate to report. But just wondering, Michael, if you have thoughts, you know, about this idea that maybe information ought to be withheld from the public. Others would argue that transparency and information is for the common good.
Yeah. Well, again, you know, I think that in order for our mental health, you know, it's really important that we feel safe and are safe, and information can really help us with that. I want again focus on some of this misinformation that was going around during the last events. That was really harmful, and spreading of rumors and keeping a conversation going and making kids and staff and first responders feel less safe than they actually are through the spreading of misinformation, I think caused some real trauma in our communities.
Bear.
I think it's really walking that line between sharing information and trying to stay in that sort of factual place and the sensationalization of you know, traumatic events. I think there's a part of our brains that, you know, really seek out. And when we're in that sort of survival space, that's the information we're keyed to is, you know, are some of the worst things. And it's easy to sensationalize. Those are the pieces that get the most attention. And so how are we sharing information? How are we making plans and being strategic and working on prevention? And really, as a community, how are we responding when things happen? How are we bringing people together? How are we providing that support? I think those are the pieces that we can look at versus sort of sensationalizing and, you know, just going back to something over and over and over again.
So I'm thinking, Bear, when you're talking about as a community coming together, and I'm thinking about Lucille's thoughts, would you say that coverage of, let's take, for example, Uvalde, coverage of how the community is coming together is as important as coverage of the shooting itself?
I mean, I think anytime we show those examples of how we're healing, of how we're validating what's been going on, how people are coming together to sort of bolster each other, how really it's not us as individuals in mourning, and that it's really us as community supporting each other. I think, you know, focusing on that is a powerful message and a reminder of that how important humanity is for our health and our well-being. And bolstering those connections to each other, you know, it's one of the best sort of safety and healing nets that we have for each other.
We're tight on time, and I want to go to this email from Jamian, and I'll turn to you, Karen. Jamian writes, "My daughter is a highly anxious child, 15. A lockdown drill has been scheduled at her school soon, and I worry this might make her fears worse. Can you discuss how to help us figure this out for our kids?"
So Jennifer, I think what's really important, and Melissa touched on this earlier, is that, you know, we really want to have trauma-informed approaches to all of our emergency management and safety procedures. So I think the National Association of School Psychologists has a great publication on there, and it really kind of talks about, you know, when for some students, we may have to alert those students ahead of time to say, listen, you know, we know you're really anxious about this. We're going to have a lockdown drill today. It's a drill. It's not, you know, a real emergency. And that's how some schools are you know, handling that situation with some real with students with some real high anxiety. But that's a great publication, I think, for parents to look at, for school personnel, because it really tailors the response to the needs of the students.
All right, Bear, just about 30 seconds. Anything to add to that?
I think just knowing that the department is here as a resource, that the Maine School Safety Center and the Office of School and Student Supports are, you know, we are really looking to put together best practices and resources for schools, and that we're working, you know, on an individual level with school communities to make sure that they have the needs that are specific and unique for their schools and districts. So, you know, that role for us is an important one and one we take really seriously and really want to connect with communities around that planning.
Well, I want to thank you all for joining us today. Karen Barnes, Behavioral Threat Assessment and Mental Health Coordinator for the Maine DOE's School Safety Center. Michael Berman, Professor of Psychology and Academic Director with UNE's School of Social and Behavioral Science in Bearshay, a social worker and mental health specialist with the Department of Education. Today's sound engineer, KG Akimoladun. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. You can go to mainecalling.org if you'd like to sign up for our free newsletter or to find any previous Maine Calling program. Tomorrow on the program, it is our annual Best and Overlooked Books program. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.